Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Muslims are Europe's fastest-growing population. An estimated 18 million now live there, often in isolated communities, frustrated by a lack of jobs and of cultural acceptance. And within their ranks, Islamist extremists, hungry to turn alienated young Muslims into terrorists and Muslim communities into citadels of jihad. The war in Iraq is making their job easier. Tonight on Point, the challenge of Islam in Europe. We begin in Washington, where a Pentagon official said this weekend that the interrogation of a prisoner in Guantanamo Bay produced intelligence that led to the major string of raids and arrests of suspected Islamic militants in Germany this month. Joining me now is Josh Meyer, intelligence reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Josh, what do you know about the reported link between Guantanamo and these arrests in Germany?
Well, I think they're still trying to figure that out right now, but clearly they're seeing connections between Guantanamo and Europe and Iraq and elsewhere. They're seeing a lot of threads between them. And one thing that I know that has U.S. authorities very, very concerned is that Europe is becoming even more of a front in the war on terrorism than it's been for many years. They're seeing a lot of people going from Germany and Italy and Spain and France and other countries to Iraq as the new Afghanistan, I guess, for lack of a better term, or the new Chechnya, and fighting against the occupying forces there, and in some cases also coming back to their home countries and preparing for trouble.
January 12th were the German raids right around the country, 22 arrested suspected militants, and now belatedly, this claim being reported by U.S. military or Pentagon sources that the intelligence that produced those arrests came from Guantanamo. Europeans have generally been quite critical of the holding facilities in Guantanamo and the treatment of prisoners there. Does this look like a genuine intelligence coup or an effort to justify the Guantanamo exercise?
Well, you said that. I didn't. No, I mean, all kidding aside, I think that you have to look at it with a good deal or some degree of skepticism, I should say. But, you know, it's so hard to tell what goes on inside Guantanamo that you really can't say. I would have to say that if that is true, that is probably one of the first pieces of really important information to come out of there, you know, since Guantanamo was, you know, since it became the sort of the terrorist holding cell that it is, or the alleged terrorist holding cell. So, you know, I await with great curiosity more details about what happened there and what this person said and what the ties are to Europe and to Iraq.
And Josh, you've pointed out that Iraq is essentially just a long drive from Europe. It must make American authorities especially sensitive about what's going on there. Of course, 9/11, the 9/11 attacks were reportedly planned in Hamburg and elsewhere in Europe. What's your sense of the level and effectiveness of cooperation between U.S. security and law enforcement officials and Europeans on this terror front?
I think there's a very good level of cooperation and communication. In fact, the Germans in particular have been cooperating very, very closely with the U.S. government. In fact, I know for a fact because I know that several very senior German officials, when they come to Washington very frequently, they meet with reporters and tell us what's happening. The one thing that they're concerned about is that Germany, for decades, has been a very, very open government, and there's a tremendous amount of freedom within that country and liberties for people. So, you know, a lot of these militant groups search out countries where they have a lot of freedom and leeway and use those to mobilize and to organize and to plot attacks. And Germany is one of those countries, and it has been a real hub for al-Qaeda and now Ansar al-Islam and Ansar al-Sunnah and some of the other offshoot groups that are causing trouble in Iraq. So they're quite concerned about that, but they're also concerned about other countries throughout Europe and elsewhere in the world.
Well, it's a big effort. Europe only a piece of it, but we're looking at it tonight. Josh Meyer, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Josh Meyer covers intelligence for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with me from Washington. We're talking this hour about Europe's unabsorbed Muslim population and the threat of Islamist radicalization inside the West. You can join the conversation. Is a large, unassimilated Muslim population in Europe a threat to Europe, a threat to the United States? And how can Europe's growing Muslim population be a bridge to understanding rather than an incubator of conflict? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Berkeley, California, is Lowell Bergman, award-winning investigative journalist, former 60 Minutes producer, and a correspondent for the PBS Frontline documentary series. His latest project is a Frontline documentary entitled Al-Qaeda's New Front, airing on PBS tomorrow night, Tuesday. Lowell Bergman, thanks for being with us.
Good evening.
You've spent a good amount of time traveling Europe, reporting in Europe on the rapidly expanding Muslim population there and its links to Islamic fundamentalism and perhaps to Islamic terrorism. How do you describe the situation Europe has on its hands?
Well, let me just follow up on some of the things that you were just referring to. Remember, in the 9/11 attacks, all the investigations pointed to Europe because there were no witting accomplices here. So it's the Hamburg cell in Europe that produced the pilots and the tactical leadership for the attack. And if you go to Europe, you can understand why. Many people call sections of Europe Eurabia. The population from primarily North Africa and Turkey has really not been absorbed into society. And you have a breeding ground, if you will, just from the television news that they see every day from Al Jazeera and elsewhere, from the Middle East, particularly from Iraq these days. And you'll see, for instance, that there are leading Muslim clerics throughout Europe, particularly, let's say, in Britain, who preach openly and cheer about the fall of the World Trade Center, show the video at mass rallies. So in Europe itself, you have a breeding ground, and to some extent, Europe, which was once a rest and recreation area for fundamentalists, a place for them to logistically get their act together, it's now become a target.
And why should this Islamist streak, this Islamic fundamentalism, be more open, more virulent in Europe than in the United States? I think a lot of Americans look at American Muslims and see a relatively well-integrated population, by and large, certainly not one that's, that's rhetorically or in any way other way generally is marching on American security. Why more open, more virulent in Europe?
Well, first of all, I think the vast majority of the Muslim population is not a threat anywhere in the world to the United States or people in the West. But it is a place where these views, the opposition to U.S. policy, et cetera, are very popular. In the United States, the Muslim population is relatively small. In Europe, it is the largest growing ethnic group and the fastest growing ethnic group and religious group in Europe. Spain, for example, 10 years ago had a minuscule Muslim population, but because of the prosperity in Spain, Muslims who once crossed into Europe across the Straits of Gibraltar, and it looks very much like the border crossings, let's say, in Tijuana and San Diego, workers coming into Europe now stop in Spain. So Spain has an estimated Muslim population of 1 million people now today, and that led to the group that pulled off the Madrid bombings. So you have a population shift going on in Europe. Plus, Europe is as one of the people we interviewed said, it's a two-day drive from Baghdad to Berlin. And once you get inside the European Union, once you become a resident or you have some resident status and papers, you can move anywhere in the European Union. If you can get in through Poland, you can wind up in London, and no one's going to stop you.
Did you find evidence that there's a flow of European Muslims from Berlin to Baghdad or from other countries in Europe to Baghdad? Is there evidence that there's a role being played in the insurgency in Iraq, or just a notion that it's possible?
Well, we know from investigations that have become public from Italy of a man named Ahmed Rabai, who we discuss in the documentary, to the announcement on Sunday by the Germans that they have detained a recruiter, someone who is actively recruiting, and a recruit heading for Iraq, that this is going on. We don't know the extent of the recruitment the actual recruitment that's happened so far. Intelligence officials say that it has the potential to rival the jihad in Afghanistan. It's not there yet, but it's happening.
And what did you find when you sat down with Islamist, I'm not sure what to call them, protagonists in Europe?
We call them Salafi. They're known by their kind of description ideologically within the Muslim religion as Salafi jihadists. And there are various versions of that, ranging from Al-Qaeda acolytes to what are called the Takfir, who basically believe that the only good thing to do is to kill infidels, and they can dress or act any way they want so as to blend in, and then all they have to do to save themselves is such an act.
And what's the point? What's the goal? What's the vision of the future that would inspire that?
Well, it appears to be a reactionary ideology that wants to go back to the an image of where Islam was 800 years ago, when there was what they referred to as the caliphate. In other words, there was a period of time where Islam was an empire, if you will, though loosely affiliated, from Spain to the Philippines. So, for instance, they actually, if you remember, 9/11. Right after 9/11, there was a videotape in which Osama bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri appeared. Mm-hmm. Well, it was just in the same day that Bush, I think, declared war on Afghanistan. In Zawahiri's statement, he said, in referring to Palestine, "You aren't going to do to us what you did to us in Andalusia," meaning Spain, meaning 1492, when the Muslims were forced out of Spain. So you hear these same words, and if you watch the documentary, you'll see someone today on the street in Berlin, an Egyptian Salafi jihadist who is a veteran of the Bali bombings, talking exactly that way.
In your new documentary, you quote Islamist leaders saying that capitalism will fall soon. We are the successor. We believe that the caliphate must be restored. Materially, what's meant by that kind of language? That they anticipate
exactly.
that Europe will become Islamic? And if that's what they anticipate, how marginal a view is that in the European Islamic community?
Well, I don't know how – it appears to be a marginal view in terms of the people that you speak with who are, let's say, local imams or community leaders in many places in Europe. But it is a driving force, a kind of ideology that is really what's behind Al-Qaeda in many ways in terms of justifying what they do. The sympathy for this point of view as another alternative way to justify what they do is, by anyone's estimate, growing.
Growing to be a significant
growing
force?
Growing in popularity, as a way to justify what people do. How do you explain not only the bombings in Madrid, but also shortly thereafter the suicides of the group involved? It's an extremist view. It's similar to the surprise that we felt on 9/11 that there were people willing to give up their lives, hijack airplanes, and crash into the World Trade Center.
And is there something about Europe that makes it more fertile ground for this view or makes Europeans less able to accommodate, live with their Muslim neighbors? What provokes this?
Well, demographically, Europe and then the growing Muslim population is also in part due to the economics. It's a place to get jobs. So whether you had people from Turkey coming to Germany in the famous guest program, or the flow of people that you can see every day in Algeciras in Spain, or ships that are being intercepted by the Italians coming from Italy and Tunisia, there's the economic draw of Europe, similar to the economic draw of the United States to the Hispanic community and the Latin American community to the south of us. And in many ways, it looks quite the same, people both legally and illegally trying to get across. So that's the demographics. The geographics are you can drive from Baghdad to Berlin. There is no moat between Europe and this potential problem. And many of the people we interviewed, particularly in the counterterrorism community, and you can see some of the leaders of the French and Spanish and Italian, as well as the British counterterrorism community, saying Iraq has increased the danger in Europe. And one of the things that we see today with the roundup in Germany that you've referred to is that you're going to see probably more of this throughout Europe as President Bush prepares to go there.
We're talking tonight about Europe's unabsorbed Muslims and the threat of Islamist radicalization inside the West. been talking with Lowell Bergman. He's an award-winning reporter and producer for Frontline. His latest PBS Frontline documentary is Al-Qaeda's New Front, airs tomorrow night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. You can join the conversation tonight, almost 4 years after the 9/11 attacks were planned in Europe. Do you see the threat of Islamist fundamentalism there growing or receding? How do you imagine the war in Iraq is influencing the outlook of Europe's Muslims? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Europe's unabsorbed Muslims and the threat of Islamist radicalization inside the West. You can join the conversation tonight. How can Europe's large and growing Muslim population be a bridge to understanding rather than an incubator of conflict? And can Europe summon up the melting pot or the tolerance of diversity to really absorb its Muslim population? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined tonight by Lowell Bergman. He's a correspondent for the PBS documentary series Frontline. He joins us tonight from Berkeley, California. We're joined now from Washington by Amer Hamzawi. He's an Egyptian political scientist who taught at Cairo University and the Free University of Berlin. He's now a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, a consultant on this issue to the German government. Amer Hamzawi, thank you for being with us tonight.
Yes, it's my pleasure. Good evening.
We're also joined from Washington by Shireen Hunter, director of the Islam Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, author of Islam, Europe's Second Religion and the Future of Islam in the West. She served as director of the Mediterranean Studies Program at the Center for European Policy Studies in Brussels. Shireen Hunter, thank you for joining us tonight. So here we have coming up tomorrow night on PBS in the States, a documentary Lowell Bergman and others have worked on, co-production with the CBC and the New York Times, essentially raising the alarm, calling Europe Al-Qaeda's new front. Amer Hamzawi, when you see Muslim Europe framed in this way, what's your response? Is this the right way of seeing this population? Is this alarmist? Is it too mild?
I guess it's going too far. I mean, speaking of Europe, Western European countries, which are basically liberal societies, which have experienced throughout the last 5 or 6 decades, in different ways, actually, how to deal with radical groups. Speaking of Europe in general as a new front for Al-Qaeda is going too far. I guess what's important to keep in mind or to point out is, one, we do have a potential, which is, however, minor. Within the Muslim communities, mainly Arab communities living in Europe, we do have a potential of radicalization, which is minor. It really does not exceed the limits of 1-2% in the worst cases, and the worst cases do exist in a country like Germany, or do exist in a country like France. I can come back later to it, I mean, to explain why does it really look a bit worse in Germany as compared to a place like Great Britain or to other countries. Second point, which really should be sort of pointed out, is the fact that we are speaking of a group which does not have the solidarity or support or sympathy of the Muslim majority in Europe. We are speaking of an isolated group which is very dangerous, which should be contained in a security sense. However, there is no danger of total radicalization within Muslim communities in Europe. Muslim communities are integrated. I feel like relativating this picture of Muslims in Europe who are not integrated, who are living on the margin of the society. Some of them do have difficult life conditions, but it applies not only to Arabs or Muslims living in Europe, but to some Europeans as well. There are great examples of the capacity of European societies to integrate and accommodate Arabs and Muslims, and even religious knowledge coming from an Islamic origin. And it's important to keep in mind that European societies have had a long experience since the 1950s, 1960s in Germany, rather earlier in France and Great Britain, in dealing with Muslim communities. It's not new, and they are integrated. There are problems. They are focusing on these problems since 9/11, but since the 1990s in general, and they are working on it. So I'm not that pessimistic, and I don't see Europe as a potential front for Al-Qaeda.
Shireen Hunter, how about your view? Al-Qaeda's new front in Europe, how do you see it?
Well, I don't. First of all, I think that the Mr. I think the reporter that is doing this,
Lowell Bergman, with us tonight.
That's right. Mm-hmm. I think that he went far too far. More importantly, to be honest with you, as a sort of pedantic academic, I have to point out that his analysis of Islamic history and empire spreading from since 8th century from Spain to Philippines is simply not correct. And Southeast Asia did not become Muslim until about 16th century, and it was done without conquest. This is just one example. A couple of other examples in terms of what he says, that you can just drive, from Baghdad to Europe, and that also simply is not true. Or you can, land in Spain and end up in London, you can do that if you have a Schengen visa. And the other thing is that not all European EU member countries are members of Schengen. So I think that this really rather makes me a little bit anxious to see that if some of these basic issues are not being, properly understood, then what are the other things? And also on the question of statistics, I think that, we don't have exact statistics, but I think that the figure of roughly between 15 to 18 million is, is understood to be the number of legal and illegal Muslims in Europe. I think Muslims in Europe, I can't get into it obviously in this program, we cannot lump them all together. Each country has its own peculiarities, and part of this derives from the fact that the Muslim communities of Europe show in some degree the colonial relationship of countries. So why they are more North Africans in France, overwhelming majority, or from Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, because those were parts that France colonized and used, those people, and later on they came.
So in Algeria and elsewhere, there's a historical connection there. We want to hear more, but Lowell Bergman, I want to turn to you. The first response we're getting from our fellow guest tonight is that this overstates the case of the threat of Islamic radicalization in Europe.
Well, I think everyone would agree that before the Madrid bombing, no one thought that there would be an upsurge or thought that there would be attacks generating from within the Muslim community in Europe against the societies there, and that came as a great shock.
Can I just interject there? Because I think that this shows that we became aware of the existence of European Muslims only after 9/11. Others who either were more, in Europe, I mean, for example, if you ask the French were the first victims of sort of rather significant bombings done by French.
Related to Algeria and
exactly,
the Hezbollah.
Absolutely.
But don't the Madrid bombings, Shireen Hunter, represent something on a new scale, a new ferocity? I mean, 181 killed, 1,400 wounded, those are big numbers.
No, but you see, for example, some of the bombings that had been planned in Paris the bombings in Paris in 1995 were not inconsequential, but moreover, there were a number of bombings which were planned that in metro stations in Paris
right.
that, had it not been, discovered, they could have had, far more impact than the Madrid bombings.
In a way, that's not comforting. But Lowell Bergman, I want to hear the rest of your reply to the general critique here.
Well, I'd have to agree with them that possibly 2% of the population is oriented towards extremely radical fundamentalism. But that's a large number of people, especially compared to the United States. I think polling and talking with any of the counterterrorism officials in Europe, and you'll see that there's a greater concern over domestic acts of terrorism within Europe itself. In the past, and some CIA officials have made these arguments, some of which you'll see on the website that's attached to this, because we couldn't conclude all the interviews,
mm-hmm.
would say that this is a big change, that in the past what we've had is Europe as a staging area, Europe as an area that had this liberal society where people could use the freedom, for instance, in London to broadcast, to put out newspapers, and to live there freely as long as they didn't do anything, as long as they weren't a specific threat. So the shock in Europe, I think, at least amongst the authorities, is that there is now a domestic threat. It isn't necessarily aimed back at Egypt or Algeria or Morocco or the places that they came from, but at the society itself.
And I'm hearing here Amr Hamzawi saying, in fact, Muslims in Europe are more integrated than you suggest, Lowellberg. When yet, I've seen the show, I've seen your documentary, and you have people there saying, for example, in France, you've got unemployment, failure in the education system, a big identity complex, feelings of rejection, frustration, disappointment, easy target for jihadi or jihad recruiters. Amr Hamzawi says, no, most people are in fact integrated.
Well, I guess I would really rather try to speak in terms of concrete numbers, because what we do have, I mean, the potential, what I meant by 1 to 2%, I didn't actually mean sort of direct potential recruitments or recruits for Al-Qaeda. We have a marginalized group within Muslim communities in Europe which does more or less empathize with jihadi, Salafi schools of thought, and they are very different and concepts can be used in different ways. However, apart from this marginal group, which does exist and it represents a security threat and it should be dealt with appropriately, apart from this marginal group, what we do have a Muslim community in Germany or in France or Belgium, which does represent social conditions in general. So we do have unemployment in Germany, which is not strictly speaking related only to Muslims. We do have over 10% of Germans or residents of Germany who are unemployed. The same rate of unemployment does exist in France, a bit less in Great Britain and other countries. So we do have societal problems which have been growing in Europe throughout the 1990s, economic recession in Germany and France and other countries, and they are reflected as far as the life conditions of Muslims are concerned. But Muslims are not specific in this regard.
But Amir Hamzawi, if I may, you're a consultant to the German government, I think, on just this issue of how they can best accommodate, assimilate, deal with the Muslim population. What are the problems that they're raising to you and saying, Amir, what shall we do?
Sure. We have two main problems, actually, in Germany, and which are very particular to the German case. One is we have been too late, actually, as far as integrating Islamic religious knowledge into schools and educational systems is concerned. We have been too late as compared to other countries in Europe. We have been too late as compared to the States, where you do have a diversity within the educational system. We have been too late in integrating Islamic religious knowledge. We left a space open for potentially radical groups to disseminate religious knowledge uncontrolled. So what we are trying to do, not only since 9/11, actually since mid-1990s, we have been trying to institutionalize in a liberal sense the transmission of Islamic religious knowledge within German schools, within German universities, so in order to combat this kind of radical transmission potentially.
And are you saying to educate native Germans about Islam or to educate German Muslims about Islam?
Exactly. Second and third generations of Arabs and Muslims living in Germany, partially German citizens, partially non-German citizens.
But are they really going to get their education in Islam from the German government?
This is the whole idea, because, I mean, we left a space open to private schools, to private institutes, and it was not controlled. So the idea is to get it controlled, centralized. Centralized in Germany means in a federal sense, centralized in each state.
Hold that thought, Lowellberg. Perhaps Germany is different. We know it is, but in the United States, sounds like an impractical idea.
I think there's a general understanding, and in the Spanish and the French have both been talking about this, that, for example, the mosques, which are funded primarily funded through the Saudi charities or Persian Gulf charities that basically espouse a Salafi version of Islam, they are beginning to feel that these are difficult situations that are causing potential security problems.
Sure,
so there is a discussion in Spain and France of having the government actually fund mosques to remove that influence.
But these are the big examples. I guess, I mean, much more dangerous and less controlled, even as compared to Saudi or Iranian or whatever examples coming from nation states, are local initiatives which have been increasingly relevant in the case of Germany. And now it's time to get it controlled, not in a sense of directly controlling it, but creating textbooks, supervising teachers who are coming to Germany.
Right, so we understand that effort, an effort to get control of Islamic education. I want to begin to bring bring our callers in. They're waiting, and we'll have more time, but let me begin to bring them in. Juan is calling from Greensboro, North Carolina. Hi, Juan. You're on the air.
I just wanted to say that and to the extent that there is a problem with Muslims assimilating, it's partially the fault of the host countries and their populations who haven't reached out to understand them. Like a good example is the case of the headscarves in France.
Mm-hmm.
I'll take my comments off the air.
Thanks. Shireen Hunter, let me turn that to you. We hear this, that the Europeans, of course, are old societies, not melting pot societies traditionally, though immigration is certainly changing that to some extent. But have the Europeans made their own problem by a failure to open themselves to their Muslim populations to assimilate or not?
Well, I think that, it's really very difficult to answer this question, and I don't want it to go on and on, but unfortunately, it's very difficult to answer this question without understanding how Muslim populations came to Europe. The fact of the matter is that the Muslim population, when they first arrived in Europe, particularly in France and Germany, and particularly in Germany, which never considered, I mean, until about a couple of years ago, the Turks, second, third generation Turks, were still considered guest workers, and they couldn't become citizens and so on and so forth. They never thought that they were going to stay there. And consequently, there really were no plans or nothing that to integrate them. They were housing, for example, project went up for single men. And then, when they came with the 1960s boom and so on and so forth, and then the bust of the 1970s, and then when their families came and so forth, so you had these huge areas. And I think that one should not underestimate. Muslim population has not become integrated. Integration happens at several levels. It happens at legal level, in a sense that they can become citizens and so forth. It happens at the economic level, which requires, education and so on and so forth. And also it happens then at the cultural level. Now, there are some segments of Muslim population that not only are integrated, but they are assimilated.
What percentage of the overall 18 million?
Oh, I think that probably, less than 5%.
Less than 5% really integrated?
Well, maybe more. I mean, assimilated.
Small in any case.
And assimilated, well-off, and so on.
Yes.
So I think that some, and interestingly, in some cases, this is not in all cases, this pockets of underclass is also in areas, depressed economic areas. For example, in UK, this is particularly the case, for example, in the north. And those are the places where the communal tension is difficult. On the other hand, it's also true that Muslim communities, and this is not just that they don't want to integrate, but it is they have a different understanding of integration. They don't think that, Germans, for example, and this is something that the German Turk who was a member of the, local member of the CDU and so on, told me that for Germans, integration means sameness, And so if Muslim cannot enjoy the Oktoberfest, he's not integrated, he's not a German. In America, we have a different sense of, civic citizenship, and which does not mean absolute loss of, ethnic identity.
Room for diversity within the assimilation.
Exactly. So on the other hand, however, I don't want to put all the blame on the side of the Europeans, because Muslims also have, if you are from a particular village, you go and try to find people who are from the same village. So as a result, they sort of congregate together. And sometimes this is because of self-help and trying to, help one another and so forth.
So it comes down on both sides. I'm afraid we're out of time before the break there. And Shireen Hunter, I know we have to let you go, but thank you for joining us.
Okay.
Shireen Hunter, the director of the Islamic Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. We're looking tonight at Europe's Islam Challenge. You can join the conversation. Is the Islamist dream of restoring Spain to Islam and rebuilding the caliphate a harmless myth or a real flashpoint? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Europe's Islam Challenge. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from Washington by Amr Hamzawi. He's an Egyptian political scientist. He's taught at the Free University in Berlin. He's a consultant to the German government, now a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And from Berkeley, California tonight by Lowell Bergman, an award-winning reporter, producer, a Frontline correspondent. The Frontline documentary coming out tomorrow night is called Al-Qaeda's new front. There's a bit of tape in that documentary that I'll play for you here, where they get Abu Hamza, recently arrested, used to preach in a big London mosque, giving his view of 9/11.
Everybody was happy when the planes hit the World Trade Center. Anybody tell you is not happy, they are hypocrites from the Muslim nation, I'm telling you. Everybody.
Why?
Because that's it. This is what you teach your people in cowboy films. When you see the aggressor has been doing bad things and then the hero comes and give him a couple of punches in his face, everybody share up, isn't it?
From the frontline documentary, Al-Qaeda's New Front, talking about Europe, there is Abu Hamza. Right now, Ed is calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Ed, you're on the air.
Thank you. I was in the Netherlands when Pim Fortuyn was killed. I'm probably mispronouncing that. But I remember the genuine shock on the part of all the Dutch people that I talked to those days. And that's one of the most open societies in the world with a fairly relaxed view of assimilation.
He was killed by an environmentalist, but he had campaigned against immigration.
Yeah, and subsequently his friend and confidant, I'm going to forget his first name, Van Gogh.
Theo Van Gogh killed last November the Dutch filmmaker who was working with a Somali Muslim woman on a film and was killed, apparently, by a Muslim attacker.
Yeah, and I guess the point that I'm trying to get at is in a society like that that's about as open and with as liberal a view of assimilation as I can imagine, I have to go back to Pim Fortuyn's initial thesis. I believe that Europe really is going to wind up having to initiate a moratorium on Muslim immigration until such time as it can be determined whether Muslim assimilation of any sort is actually possible. I personally do not believe it is in the current state of the Islamic world.
Ed, we've got it. Lowell Bergman, how about that? Do you hear that sentiment in Europe? Is that considered racist or chauvinist or practical or what?
Well, there is commentary like that, and Europe, you know, by comparison to the United States, Europe doesn't have a great record of assimilating minority groups who are not homogeneous with their population. They fought great wars over many centuries over the fact that ethnic groups didn't get along. And now they're dealing, I think, in some ways with the fact that they allow this immigration. It's very central to the economics of Western Europe in particular to have a cheap labor supply, and this is their cheap labor supply. But I think that the danger that's being passed over here is not so much that Europe also has these great social problems, but they also have a political problem. They have liberal societies. So you have somebody like Omar Bakri, who is a sheikh in London, preaching, as it's been reported, 2 weeks ago before an audience of 500, and saying God is great, while they showed pictures of the World Trade Center attack.
And that's protected speech in a liberal society.
Essentially, that's protected speech as long as you're not inciting or conspiring. And it's that has now is coming to the forefront in terms of attention of the authorities. And to a certain extent, Europe has to deal with the, if you will, whether their country backs our policies or not, with the backlash against U.S. policies. So that is what's fermenting in the European society, and I think it would be putting your head in the sand to say that it isn't.
Imad's calling from Northborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Imad. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Good to have you, my friend.
Thank you. A couple of comments here. First, I would like to make a distinction between two terms that are used interchangeably.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is fundamentalism, and the second one is extremism. I think frequently we refer to extremists, ill-informed groups who act on their own misinterpretation of the religion as fundamentalists.
So in other words, if we're going to have Christian fundamentalists in America and not see them as terrorists, you're saying extend the same courtesy to Muslims?
Well, I'm not sure if you really can apply that to Christians even, you know. My understanding of... Hello?
Hello.
Yeah, my understanding of fundamentalism is, you know, somebody who applies the fundamentals of what he believes in into his life.
Okay, we've got it. Imad, and your second point?
My second point is I see a lot of digging into the quote-unquote, the coming threat of Muslims, the Muslim fundamentalism. I don't see a lot being done about understanding where these groups are coming from. I'm not saying, you know, to justify what they're doing.
Right.
When a kid starts shooting in school, you know, you have like thousands of psychologists and social workers trying to understand what's going on.
Right.
It doesn't mean they justify what's happening.
Imad, our time is short, but we've got it. Let me put that to Amr Hamzawi. Amr, if Europe essentially shares a border with the Islamic world, if Europe can't figure out a way to deal with its own Muslim population, it doesn't seem like a good indicator for the future of general Islamic relations with the West.
What it seems actually to me is that you guys are sort of having the impression that Europe has not managed to figure out a way of dealing with Muslim communities.
And you're saying,
in
fact, it's doing it.
I mean, it's not true. I mean, what Shireen Hunter said about sameness instead of integrating is not true. It doesn't apply to the German case. It's a stereotyping sort of knowledge about Germany, which doesn't hold in reality.
But what about the Dutch? The Netherlands bent over backwards to do everything for assimilation, and we've heard voices from there in recent months saying it didn't work.
No, I mean, what didn't work in the Netherlands was not the concept of integration, which is still very successful if you look to Moroccans, if you look to Turks, if you look to Somalians or whatever minorities from the Muslim world, which did sort of settle down in the Netherlands. The concept of integration of the Dutch society has been working and going on very well. There are some structural problems related to social problems in general, related to this uncontrolled radical religious knowledge, which should be controlled, and related to this very minor group within Muslim communities, third generation, second and third generation, which are sort of getting radical with reference to conflicts in the Middle East, be it Palestine, be it Iraq, or even leaving the Middle East and looking at the Muslim world as such, going to Afghanistan. However, please let us put it into context. It's not true when you say, or when someone suggests, that the integrating concept of Germany or the Netherlands or France is not working. They are working, they are different, they are particular, but it's not about sameness. We have a very intensive discussion, Jim, about multiculturalism, sure, about a leading culture, which is defined in the German understanding of enlightenment and Protestant Christianity and what have you. However, we do have a multicultural society. It's daily life. It's there. It's there in the Netherlands. And
we
France
take your point. Our time is out. It still sounds like a tall order to control religious education to that extent in this era of so many kinds of communication. But Amr Hamzawi, we appreciate your being with us tonight, and thanks for joining us. Lowell Bergman, producer with Frontline, Al Qaeda's New Front, airs tonight on PBS nationally.
Tomorrow night, Tuesday.
Thank you for being with us, Lowell Bergman.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a setback for stem cell research. This is On Point. In a setback for medical research in the United States, researchers have announced that the country's federally approved lines of human embryonic stem cells are contaminated with a molecule from mice. If eventually used for patient therapies, they could provoke an immune reaction that would destroy their ability to deliver hoped-for cures for diseases like Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and diabetes. The research finding was reported yesterday in the journal Nature Medicine, and it turns up the heat on the Bush administration's policy of providing federal funding only for research using specific embryonic stem cell lines created before August 2001. Fred Gage is a professor of genetics at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies in La Jolla, California, and co-author of the study. I asked him to explain how the stem cell lines came to be contaminated in the first place.
Most of the work that's been done on ES cells up until just recently...
ES cells meaning...
Embryonic stem cells.
Yes.
...is with mouse embryonic stem cells. So for the last 20 years, most of the work that's been done with embryonic stem cells uses mouse stem cells. And it was discovered some time ago that they grow best in conditions which contain these mouse fibroblast lines. There's something that's being secreted by these mouse fibroblasts which keep the pluripotent embryonic stem cells in their pluripotent state.
So now we come to the human stem cells, which came from what? Came from couples who had been involved in vitro fertilization. They had embryos left over. They were donated. The stem cells were extracted. And pluripotent, that is, they could evolve into potentially many different kinds of adult stem cells, and these were kept in that state, even the human stem cells, in something, some material from mice?
Yeah, the idea was that people were having trouble growing the human embryonic stem cells. They wanted to get them, but they weren't able to keep them in a primitive state. So they just used the technique that was being used for the mouse embryonic stem cell, and that was to grow them on these mouse fibroblast lines, which is a separate cell type, which then you could take the human cells and put them on there, and it turned out that they worked great, that the mouse feeder line acted as a source of support for these human embryonic stem cells and maintained them in a primitive state.
It worked great, except that your research now shows they, one way or another, absorbed some of the characteristics or the elements of the mouse host material, which will have what effect potentially if the stem cells are eventually used to treat humans?
If the human cells that are currently being grown on the mouse cells would be transplanted directly into a human for some therapeutic indication, and that's not immediately going to happen, but if it were to happen
down the road,
they would elicit an immune response, and those cells would be rejected. The human cells would be rejected from the human. So what one needs to do in this case is to discover conditions of growing human embryonic stem cells that don't include animal byproducts.
But what about at the policy level when President Bush made his 2001 address saying that we'll use these stem cells and no more? He said at that time there were 60 such lines available. It turned out only 20 were thought to be usable. After your discoveries, maybe none of those are usable, or am I wrong?
Well, I think that what we need to consider is that when a cell divides and when a cell is maintained for a period of time, many of the products that are being used in the cell themselves are turning over. So if you could find a condition that did not contain these mouse products, and we call it a defined medium, so you know everything there, it's all human.
Right.
If you took the existing lines and grew them on that clean medium for a period of time, it's very likely that the animal byproducts would be extruded from the cell itself.
So they could, in effect, be cleansed by growing.
Exactly right. You could clean them up. That's our prediction. We were not able to do that. We did put them in a condition without the animal product for a while and reduced the amount of mouse product that was expressed on the surface, but we didn't get rid of it altogether.
California's just passed a big referendum last fall, putting $300 million a year toward embryonic stem cell research. Is it possible that you in California or people elsewhere in the country or the world will come up with entirely new embryonic stem cell lines that will never be fed with in a mouse medium that won't have this risk, this problem?
It's likely that that will occur, and it's likely that also in parallel with that, once you discover this media, then you could use it for the existing approved lines and see whether or not you could clean those up so that people outside of California could also be working on lines and have it supported by NIH.
And is that kind of clean media for feeding the stem cells available today, for sustaining them? Is it available now, or you're waiting for that to be discovered, as you
there
said?
There are a few laboratories that are working, I would say probably more than a few. There are many laboratories that are working on trying to find a non-animal source to maintain the cells in a pluripotent state. This is not a new idea that we as researchers knew that growing the cells, the human cells in an animal environment was probably not the best idea. So this is not really that big of a surprise. What we've done is to demonstrate a clear example where it can be deleterious. But knowing what the problem is allows you to solve the problem. And I really do think the problem is understanding how to maintain an embryonic stem cell, human embryonic stem cell, in its most pluripotent state. And by understanding the mechanisms of how that occurs, then you can define a media which is ideally suited for those cells. That media, whether or not it's made based on NIH funding or California funding, will be useful to many, many people.
Fred Gage, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Fred Gage is a professor of genetics at the Salk Institute. His findings appear in the February issue of Nature Medicine. He spoke with me from San Diego, California. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.